The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello again, everyone. Welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Thank you to Richard Palmer for filling in for me yesterday. Well, we talk a lot about family breakdown on this program. We refer you back to some of the things Herbert Armstrong said a half century ago. You think about his classic works, The Missing Dimension in Sex, Why Marriage, and other such writings. In that marriage booklet, he said marriages are not only breaking down all around us, the very usefulness and desirability of the custom is being seriously questioned. Is marriage on the way out? After all these generations and centuries? Is the home and family life to disappear from human society? Those are some of the questions he posed in 1968. And that was a shocking time in many ways. The sexual revolution was well underway. Divorce had exploded onto the scene as an easy out alternative to bad marriages or to satisfy the lusts of the flesh. But if you look at 1968 and compare it to today, 50 years later, 49 years later, look at how much worse it is today. Back in the 60s, today, if you compare it to the 60s, you have only 1/4 of American households that even have children in those homes. You compare that to about half in 1960. And you just go right through the statistics. The number of children that women were having, much lower today than it was in the 60s. Of course, the curse of fatherlessness, children living apart from their biological father, much, much worse today than it was in the 60s. Some 15 million children in America are fatherless, living apart from their biological father. Look at all the illegitimate births. Look at the plague of divorce. Divorce today, it's held steady at about 1 in 2 over the last couple decades, but compared to the mid-1960s, the divorce rate is about twice what it was then. And so, then some of the more recent developments covered in our booklet, Joel Hilliker's booklet on the family breakdown, talking about homosexual rights, in particular homosexual marriage, transgender rights, anything you can think of in this age of Sodom and Gomorrah, just as the Bible prophesied. Jesus said it would be like the days of Sodom and Gomorrah. He said it'd be like the days just before the flood, when people were carrying on, eating, drinking, marrying, giving in marriage, right up until the floodwaters came. He says, likewise, as it was in the days of Lot, they did eat, they drank, they bought and sold, they planted and built it. In so many ways, it seemed like a prosperous society. It seemed like there were lots of things to go around. But as Mr. Armstrong warned, this is in Missing Dimension in Sex, since it's a basic truism that a solid family structure is the foundational bulwark of any stable and permanent society, this fact means only one thing. Civilization, as we know it, is on the way down and out. It's on the way down and out because of this family breakdown. Because the family, the foundation of the family, it's breaking apart. And he said that this was a greater threat to our society than even the hydrogen bomb. That's quite a statement for him to make, but look at the sickness. Look at the sickness from within. We've talked so much in recent months about the growing dangers abroad, but there have been quite a few commentators that have weighed in after the election of Donald Trump and that have said that's a sign, really. It's a sign. It shows us just how much so many Americans, tens of millions of Americans, are gravely concerned about what's happening inside of America. Now, his new decree or credo is America first, President Trump's, that is. Because so many Americans know that there's a sickness within. Nicholas Eberstadt had a lengthy piece at Commentary last week about this societal sickness inside of America. And he talks about a lot of these problems that Herbert Armstrong was sounding the alarm about back in the 1960s. These gnawing problems, so many of them are by no means new, he says. A number of them, such as family breakdown, can be traced back at least to the 1960s, while others are arguably as old as modernity itself. Secularization and the decline of faith and so on. But notice what he says here. But the number have roared down upon us. But a number of these problems, he says, have roared down upon us by surprise since the turn of the century. And others have redoubled with fearsome new intensity since roughly the year 2000. So we've been coming apart at the seams, really, for the past three or four generations. But as he brings out in this commentary piece, a number of social ills have worsened significantly just since the turn of the century, just since the year 2000. In fact, the title of his piece is Our Miserable 21st Century. Now, that caught my attention this morning just because of what we've said since May 5th, 2001. We have an entire book titled The Last Hour, based upon that message my father gave back on May 5th, 2001. He referred to it in a Key of David program a few years ago. Here's what he had to say, clip one.
God began to reveal this truth about the last hour to the Philadelphia Church of God on May 5th, 2001. That's all about John's epistles. Approximately 4 months later came the September 11th terrorist attacks on the U.S. I believe God allowed us to receive this physical sign that we had entered the last hour. The worst terrorist attack ever on American soil powerfully reinforced our new revelation about the last hour.
That worst terrorist attack ever on American soil. It just reinforced this new revelation, he said there. That's from a Key of David program he gave back in 2011. And as I say, that original message from 2001, the content, we worked that up into the book, The Last Hour. Based on that message, my father wrote in the book, we may be witnessing the worst hour ever in God's work. From now on, we're in the last hour. A time like no other. He said, we're going to experience the worst turmoil and violence ever on earth. Think about 2 Timothy 3, a prophecy we go through often. The dangerous, the perilous times that we're entering into. And of course, that same passage talks about the godlessness. It talks about the family breakdown. In the last hour, my father said, we now live in a dramatically new and far more dangerous time. It'll be the worst hour ever in human history. The worst hour ever. So this is the world that your Bible says that we've been living in since 2001. And so when Eberstadt in his commentary piece talks about how it's taken a dramatic turn for the worse in the United States since the turn of the century, Eberstadt says, from work to income to health to social mobility, the year 2000 marked the beginning of what has become a distressing era for the United States. Since the turn of the century, this miserable 21st century, we've been living in a distressing time here in the U.S. And coming out from that, you're seeing elections like what we had in November in the United States. Elections that just turned the whole political class on its head, basically. Things are badly wrong in the United States, Eberstadt says. They've been going wrong, they've been going badly wrong since the beginning of this century. And you know what? He doesn't even talk about America's string of foreign policy failures or all the wars that America has lost or the decline of the military or the breakdown of government in Washington, D.C., or the rising debt levels to go from $5 trillion in debt to $20 trillion in debt just in this time period, just in the last hour. But what he does address in this article, our miserable 21st century, a lot of it's shocking. He says, it turns out that the year 2000 marks a grim historical milestone of sorts for our nation. For whatever reasons, the great American escalator, which had lifted successive generations of Americans to ever higher standards of living and levels of social well-being, broke down around then and broke down very badly. For whatever reason, he doesn't know why, but he just says for whatever reason, the year 2000 marks a grim historical milestone. We're seeing things break down like never before. He says the warning lights have been flashing and the klaxons sounding for more than a decade and a half, but our pundits and prognosticators and professors and policymakers, ensconced as they generally are deep within the bubble, were for the most part too distant from the distress of the general population to see it or hear it. And so the ruling class on both coasts in the United States, they're in the bubble, he says. That's how it's set up here, this article. And they didn't recognize just how disgruntled everybody in between the coasts was. They didn't see the distress of the general population. Or they ignored these problems. He talks first about the economy, the dysfunctional economy, as he says. We're witnessing an ominous and growing divergence between three trends that should ordinarily move in tandem: wealth, output, and employment. He says, between late 2000 and late 2007, per capita GDP growth averaged less than 1.5% per annum. It says that compares with the nation's long-term post-war 1948 to 2000 per capita growth of almost 2.3%. So you had this sustained growth of 2.3% from the end of World War II all the way through to 2000. And then after that, it's been in decline. I mean, these might seem like small changes, but looking at it as far as this massive economic engine that the United States is, if the 21st century America's GDP trends have been disappointing, labor force trends have been utterly dismal. Work rates have fallen off a cliff since the year 2000 and are at their lowest levels in decades. We can see this by looking at the estimates by the Bureau of Labor Statistics for the civilian employment rate, the jobs-to-population ratio for adult civilian men and women. It says between early 2000 and late 2016, America's overall work rate for Americans age 20 and older underwent a drastic decline. And it talks about a lot of the things we've noted before on this program and at thetrumpet.com. Just people dropping out of the workforce and turning to government It's becoming more and more of a welfare state. He says that for every unemployed American, this is someone that's out of work, that's looking for a job, that's actively working to find work. For every unemployed American man between the age of 25 and 55, in other words, someone right in the prime of his life, right in the prime of his work life, for every one of those individuals looking for work, there's three others who aren't. There's three others who aren't working and who are not looking for work. And as you probably know, the unemployment statistics, they don't count those other three. They just count the one. And so what does this tell you? Well, there's, as he brings out, just to give you the bottom line, there's 10 million Americans. If you just look at, to quote him, if our nation's work rate today were back up to its start of the century highs, well over 10 million more Americans would currently have paying jobs. If it was just the way it was in the year 2000, that wasn't that long ago. That's just a little over 15 years ago. And of course, we entered into the last hour on May 5th, 2001. Eberstadt says there's no way to sugarcoat these awful numbers. They are not a statistical artifact that can be explained away by population aging or by increased educational enrollment for adult students or by any other genuine change in contemporary American society. The plain fact is that 21st century America has witnessed a dreadful collapse of work. And it's affected millions upon millions of Americans. At least 10 million more Americans should be working if we were just at the level that it was in 2000. He talks further about the mortality rate and this culture of dependency on the nanny state and the problem of drug abuse. Eberstadt writes, American health conditions seem to have taken a seriously wrong turn in the new century. It's not just that overall health progress has been shockingly slow, despite trillions we devote to medical services each year. He said, which Cold War babies among us would have predicted we'd live to see the day when life expectancy in East Germany was higher than in the United States? As is the case today. You go back 20 or 30 years at the peak of the Cold War. Who would have thought in America that there would be a time when life expectancy in East Germany would be higher than it is in the United States? Well, Eberstadt cites this study, a 2015 paper by these two scholars, about the rising death rates for middle-aged U.S. whites. White people in the United States. And you've seen some articles on this, perhaps. We've touched on a few here on the program. But this article here does a great job of just really showing the extent of these problems. It says health has been deteriorating for a significant swath of white America in our new century, thanks in large part to drug and alcohol abuse. All this sounds a little too close for comfort to the story of modern Russia, with its devastating vodka and drug-binging health setbacks. Yes, Eberstadt says, it can happen here, and it has. Welcome to our new America. We have a lot of the same kinds of problems that other nations have now. Problems we didn't used to have, certainly not on this scale. The opioid epidemic of pain pills and heroin that has been ravaging and shortening lives from coast to coast is a new plague for our new country. The terrifying novelty of this particular drug epidemic, of course, is that it has gone, so to speak, mainstream this time. Affecting breakout from disadvantaged minority communities to Main Street white America. And it says here, by 2013, according to this report that it cites, more Americans died from drug overdoses largely but not wholly opioid abuse, more Americans died from drug overdoses than from either traffic fatalities or guns. You hear all the response to gun violence. You hear not as much about traffic fatalities. And then how much do you hear about the drug overdoses? Because that's worse than the other two. It goes on and gives just a shocking example of so many who are addicted to painkillers. There's 7 million American men taking some kind of pain medication daily. And this article brings out how that so much of that pain medication is very expensive. How can they afford it? He refers to this other book, I believe. It's called Dreamland, where it talks about how so many of these individuals addicted to painkillers can get the drugs for next to nothing because of Medicaid, because of the government. The government, in other words, funding drug addictions by the millions. It says, in 21st century America, dependence on government has thus come to take on an entirely new meaning. This is the new America. This is 21st century America. He says further, another trend that really has worsened significantly just in the last 15, 16 years is the growing criminal class. The trend did not begin in our century, but it has taken on breathtaking enormity since the year 2000. Since the year 2000, most Americans, I think, are familiar with the fact that we have about 2 million men incarcerated in prison. And that's one of the top figures in the world as far as our overall population. The number of people that we have in prisons. But there's also quite a few that have been in prison or that have been convicted of felonies that are no longer in prison. And that number is growing, and dramatically so. It says maybe 90% of all sentenced felons today are out of confinement and living more or less among us. So we've got a lot in prison. The Obama administration was often pointing that out. But 90% are now out of confinement. He says the reason, the basic arithmetic of sentencing and incarceration in America today, correctional release and sentenced community supervision, probation and parole guarantee a steady annual flow of convicted felons back into society to augment the very considerable stock of felons and ex-felons already there. And this stock is by now truly enormous. He cites some studies here and then draws some conclusions and makes an estimate that the number of former felons in America right now numbers around 23 million. I mean, just the figures he throws out, 7 million American men, just men, addicted to pain medication, or at least taking it every day. 23 million felons. 23 million back out into the streets. I mean, that doesn't mean they're all committing crimes, but it certainly represents a growing criminal class. Eberstadt concludes here, social mobility has always been the jewel in the crown of the American mythos and ethos, it says. The idea, not without a measure of truth to back it up, was that people in America are free to achieve according to their merit and their grit, unlike in other places, where they are trapped by barriers of class and misfortune or misrule. Nearly two decades into our new century, there are unmistakable signs that America's fabled social mobility is in trouble, perhaps even in serious trouble. Now, there have been some conservative commentators that have picked up on Eberstadt's piece at Commentary, and I noticed at Commentary today that it's the most read piece there, or the top read piece that's been posted there recently. But there have also been some voices that have maybe said, well, it's not quite as bad as what Eberstadt brings out. I mean, the working class, they were upset. And that they did rise up in support of a new outsider in Donald Trump. But a lot of these problems are fixable. We can turn this around if we focus more on America first. But we'll talk more about this when we come back. But as I say, you read about the things that he addresses just in his lengthy piece, the growing criminal class, the problem with drug addiction and being addicted to painkillers and the mortality rate and the economy and the decline of work, the decline of work in the United States. You add that to so many of the other curses that are happening at home and abroad. And it's Leviticus 26. And it really has intensified just since the turn of the century. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. Is there a more urgent expression in the Bible than the last hour? When he wrote his epistles, the Apostle John thought it was the last hour before Christ's second coming. In fact, it was only a type of our time today. Every detail of what John prophesied is now being fulfilled. Request the last hour. Never before has proper time management been more important, and this book will give you the urgency you need to organize your life God's way. Request The Last Hour. As part of this free offer, request The 7 Laws of Success by Herbert W. Armstrong, one of his most popular books ever. If you want to be a successful life organizer, then you need to read The 7 Laws of Success by Herbert W. Armstrong. Again, both books are completely free. So contact us now and get the help you need to organize your life God's way. The Trumpet Daily.
We are back after a few technical difficulties. At least they came during the break. That's good. In any event, back to this subject of the last hour, May 5th, 2001. That's when my father announced that this world had entered into its last hour before what? Before the return of Christ. And 4 months after he made that announcement, the United States of America was attacked on September 11th. As I said in the first segment, it was the worst terrorist attack ever carried out on U.S. soil. Now, you can go back to that program I played a clip for you in the first segment, or you can go to the book itself, The Last Hour, and see there how my father says that God allowed that attack at that time to serve as a signal. A signal to the United States and to the rest of the world that we had entered into the last hour. It's all a sign of just how close we are to the return of Jesus Christ and the establishment of God's government on this earth. Let me just take you through a few verses from that section of Scripture, 1 John 2, where my father pulled that phrase. The last hour, 1 John 2, let's start though first in verse 15. It says, love not the world, neither the things that are in the world. If any man love the world, the love of the Father is not in him. The ways of this world, don't love it. Come out of it. Come out of it. Verse 16 says, for all that is in the world, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, the pride of life is not of the Father, but is of the world. It's Satan's world, and you see it. You see it with all of these sicknesses, these addictions, the disease, the laziness, the lack of affection for family, for children, for parents. Verse 17, the world passes away in the lust thereof, but he that does the will of God abides forever. Everything in this world, it's not God's world, it's Satan's world. We just went through in class this morning, Ephesians 2 there, where it talks about the Satan, the devil, the god of this world, as the prince of the power of the air, and how that, as Mr. Armstrong wrote in Mystery of the Ages, he just surcharges the air with his attitudes, with his impulses. And Mr. Armstrong said he couldn't have understood this truth without the development of modern technology, specifically the radio and TV signal that travels through the air in some cases, and how that the human spirit in man, it receives that signal. It's automatically tuned into it. And you see Satan's fingerprints all over what's happening in this world. You should. Anyway, you should. And yet most people, even in the traditional Christian world, they just dismiss the devil and his demons as not really having much of an influence at all. I mean, maybe they accept there's a little bit of evil here or there, or the evil is with that group or that party or that religion. But for the most part, everyone believes that this is God's world, when the Bible says exactly the opposite. Well, that world, though, is coming to an end. Satan's reign on this earth, it's about over. We're in the last hour. And verse 18, it says here, little children, it is the last time, or as it should read, it's the last hour. The Revised Standard Version has it correctly there. Little children, it is the last hour. And as you have heard, that Antichrist shall come, even now are there many Antichrists, whereby we know that it is the last hour. And so that hour has now come upon us. And that's why we're witnessing the worst hour ever. The worst hour ever. From now on, my father said in the book, we're in the last hour, and it's going to be a time like no other. And so it's no coincidence that it just, or it's not a random occurrence, this sudden spike of laziness, drug addiction, all of these societal ills, the breakdown in government, these attacks from abroad, America's military being hollowed out, America in retreat. I mean, this has been a century of defeat for the United States. Leave aside what Eberstadt talked about at home in the U.S. Where are the victories? America doesn't win anymore. Donald Trump's correct about that. We're not winning. It's one loss after another loss after another loss. And this is the world's lone superpower. This is the one that's maintained the global order since the end of World War II. And so what happens after America, as Mark Stein put it, what happens when you reach that point of after America? Just look at what's happened since May 5th, 2001, or as Eberstadt brings out in his piece, look at what happens, or what has happened, since the turn of the century. He says, for whatever reason, we're not exactly sure, but there's been a sharp increase in so many of these sicknesses, in so many of these problems. Whatever reason, we don't know exactly why it's happening, but it's happening. Well, we can go much further than that. We know why this is happening. We know why it's all beginning to unravel. Or as Charles Murray said in his book, I read from it last year, we know why it's coming apart. It's prophesied. Leviticus 26, let's go through some of it. Verse 14, it says, but if you will not hearken unto me, and will not do all these commandments, and if you shall despise my statutes, or if your soul abhors my judgments, so that you will not do all my commandments, but that you break my covenant, I also will do this unto you. I will even appoint over you terror, consumption, and the burning ague that shall consume the eyes and cause sorrow of heart, And you shall sow your seed in vain, and your enemies shall eat it. God sends curses. You can read about it in Leviticus 26 here. Deuteronomy 28 as well. Of course, you need to go further into this study and pull out the United States and Britain in prophecy and see where we are in prophecy and see who we are in prophecy. He says in verse 17, "And I'll set my face against you, and you shall be slain before your enemies. They that hate you shall reign over you. And you shall flee when none pursues. And if you will not yet for all this hearken unto me, then I will punish you 7 times more for your sins." God's trying to get our attention. I mean, this world is off the rails. Look at what the United States is going up against at home and abroad. Nikki Haley gave a speech in the UN, I think it was on Monday, or maybe it was the end of last week, where she comes out of a meeting on the Middle East there in the General Security Council of the United Nations, and she's just kind of shocked at what was discussed. Here you've got Hezbollah moving missiles into southern Lebanon. You've got ISIS on the move in the Middle East. I mean, this is a conference. This is a meeting on the Middle East at the United Nations. You've got Iran moving with Russia in Syria. Assad, he's not being held to account for his crimes. And what's the topic of discussion in that UN meeting? Well, it's about what Israel's doing, of course. The lone democracy in the region. The lone democracy. How do you explain that? I mean, this is a world that's gone mad. And there's sickness and disease, physically and spiritually. It's that way because of Satan the devil. He's real. He and his demons have been confined to this earth. Going back to the United States and Britain in prophecy, it says, "But after God," well, I don't need to read this. It's basically about the birthright promises and how that they were withheld for 2,520 years. And God gave them to our people because of a promise he made to Abraham. We didn't deserve it, but God made an unconditional promise to Abraham, and he kept it. He kept it. I mean, we've had the very best. Eberstadt brings that out in his piece. I mean, he says, look, since the end of World War II, it's just been an astonishing escalator. A little bit better, more prosperous for each oncoming generation. And then that all came screeching to a halt in 2000 or thereabouts. And now the decline is setting in, and it's happening so fast. Well, the point Mr. Armstrong makes is that once God fulfilled his promises to the people of Britain and to the people of the United States, then he was no longer obligated to continue blessing our peoples with all of this prestige, this wealth, this greatness, this power. He gave us this unrivaled position that we once had. But as Mr. Armstrong brings out, once he gave that to us, well, then it was up to us to keep it, to hold on to it. But what have we done? We've squandered it away. I mean, there's never been an empire like the British Empire. Unfathomable wealth. The master of global trade. The sun never setting on the British Empire. And yet look at how swift Britain's demise was following World War II. Little Britain left practically bankrupt, unable to sustain the costs of the empire and offloading all of those jewels. It was a fairly smooth transition. Their demise to the United States' rise in power, peaking in the middle of the 20th century. It was a smooth transfer for the most part because it's, they're brother nations. They're related. But as Eberstadt brings out in his piece, look, America's run is over. It's over. There's no more smooth sailing for the United States. Sickness has set in. Sickness and disease. And as I say, Eberstadt just talks about three or four major developments within the United States. Look at what's happening abroad, though. Verse 19 of Leviticus 26 says, I will break the pride of your power, and I will make your heaven as iron and your earth as brass. That's why we said in November 2001, you have September 11th, then you have us working on our Trumpet magazine right after that, September and October, and then the November issue. You have us. You have God's work. You have the Trumpet magazine telling you what would happen in the war in Afghanistan and later Iraq, this war against terrorism. We said this, while the U.S. wants to eliminate terrorism and is becoming much more aggressive in trying to do so, its efforts will fall short. It frankly does not have the necessary will to tackle the enormity of the problem. Is there anybody else that was saying that in November 2001? We had gone into the last hour. We were just months into the last hour. Who else was saying? I mean, here the United States, it was quite a showing of force. The troops and the equipment and the military power and might we were sending over to Afghanistan and then later to Iraq. And God's work, a lone voice, saying that we'd fall well short of our goal. Remember President Bush. He said that the war wouldn't end until every terrorist group of global reach has been found, stopped, and defeated. That's what the President of the United States said after 9/11. This war against terrorism would continue until every terrorist group of global reach has been found, stopped, and defeated. Well, who's been defeated? Who's retreated from the Middle East since he made that statement? Who's gone from Iraq for the most part? Who's gone from Afghanistan for the most part? Who's gone from the Middle East? We said in November 2001, as we now examine the facts emerging from this war, and keep in mind, this was written a month after 9/11. As we now examine the facts emerging from this war, we can see unequivocally that the terrorist snake will survive America's aggression, head intact, and stronger than ever. And you know who the terrorist snake is? Well, it's Iran. And it came through all of that. These past 15 years, 16 years, stronger than ever before. And now it's on the path to being a nuclear state. Just a few more years. And it got all those hundreds of billions of dollars from the Obama administration. Some of it delivered in cash. Secretly. Just last year. It's all unfolding just like we said that it would. Think about this statement. This is from November 2001. I got into this Monday, I know. The Trumpet. I mean, you see the headlines today. You see what's happening today. You see the things outlined in Eberstadt's article, as I went through in the first segment. And who was talking about it in the 1960s? Who's been talking about this for the past two decades? As far as the Trumpet is concerned. In November 2001, we wrote, there will soon come a point when the U.S. won't even be a factor in this war. Now look at what's happening today. Look at where we are today. Hardly a factor. I mean, we're trying to get Putin. We're trying to get Russia to help us with battling against ISIS. There's hardly any U.S. forces going against it. Not directly. Not even a factor. Who could have said that? Who would have said that? Who would have been as crazy enough to say that in 2001? The United States not even being a factor in this war against terrorism? Really? We said it. We said it in 2001. We said it when the United States was angry. We said it as the United States was unleashing a fury on Afghanistan and later Iraq. Look at what we said when Iraq was taken out of the picture. 2003, I mean, that's a couple years in, and the U.S. is riding high. But we wrote this: now that Iraq has been taken out of the picture, Iran is even closer to becoming the reigning king of the Middle East. It may seem shocking, given the U.S. presence in the region right now, but prophecy indicates that in pursuit of its goal, Iran will probably take over Iraq. At least it will have a heavy influence over the Iraqi people. Prophecy tells. Prophecy tells, and so many since that time have talked about Iran being the single biggest beneficiary of that U.S.-led invasion in 2003. Stratford said that in 2011. Who's the real victor here? Who's the one that came out on top? Who's the one that's stronger than ever? And who's the one that's no longer a factor? And who's the one that told you about all this? Even as the war against terrorism was starting. Verse 20 in Leviticus 26 says, "And your strength shall be spent in vain, for your land shall not yield her increase, neither shall the trees of the land yield their fruits." Your strength is just going to be spent. Spent in vain. So what do we have to show for this war against terrorism? One that we started back in November of 2001. One in which President Bush said that, you know, we're going to continue this until every single terrorist group of global reach has been defeated. What do we have to show for it? Well, we handed Iraq over to Iran. We've given the Middle East, as far as the bigger picture goes, we've given the Middle East to Russia for the time being. I mean, there's going to be more changes ahead. We've seen the whole region turned on its head, the Arab Spring. All of this turmoil in Libya, all of these terrorist attacks, hundreds of thousands that have been slain in Syria. And you have the UN getting together to talk about the problem that Israel is. That's coming right from the Ephesians 2:2 influence. Strength spent in vain. America's national debt, the day before 9/11, it was around $5.7 trillion. And today it's near $20 trillion. Look at what it's done. Among other things, look at what it's done to the United States. Just economically. God says, "And if you walk contrary to me," this is verse 21, "and will not hearken to me, I will bring seven times more plagues upon you according to your sins." See, this individual that wrote it, commentary, says that for whatever reason, it just seems like it's gotten a lot worse. Well, not seems. The statistics show it's so much worse. We don't know why. But it's really gotten bad. Well, there is hope. There is hope. Because, as I said earlier, when you enter into the last hour, when you enter into that period of the last hour, that hour concludes with the return of Jesus Christ. Now, God's trying to get our attention. And that's why 9/11 happened when it did. But we have to keep our minds on the end of this hour as well. And my father brings that out, or he brought that out in that program from 2011. This is from 5-6 years ago, clip 2.
Now, that when that was revealed, it was about 4 months before September the 11th, 2001, when the attack on the Twin Towers occurred. And we believe that God just allowed that to happen to reinforce His revelation that we are in the last hour. Now, that may seem ridiculous to some people, but this is New Testament doctrine, and God says these prophecies and all of the New Testament and the Old Testament are there to be understood. And especially those prophecies that are for this last hour or this end time, the last hour of man ruling over man, and then after some very deadly problems we're going to have to face, Jesus Christ is going to return at the end of that hour and give us peace and joy forever. Now that's something to get excited about.
It is indeed. It is something to get excited about. I mean, we're getting that close to the end of this age. And what God's allowed to happen on September the 11th and what we've seen over these past 15, 16 years, I mean, it should just reinforce the fact that we're in the last hour. It reinforces, as he said there, his revelation, God's revelation. And it should also open our eyes to what's happening right now in the United States. Around the world. Mr. Armstrong said, do you think so great a fall could not come to so great powers as Britain and America? Do you say it can't happen here? I mean, Eberstadt says something similar to that in his piece. Well, you think it can't happen here? Well, look, it's happening. We're not Russia. We're not a bunch of addicts and drunks. Well, open your eyes and look at what's happening inside of the United States, inside of Great Britain. Do you think the great God, he says, who was able to give them such unprecedented world leadership and power and wealth is not able to take it away from them and throw them, like their ancient forefathers, back into slavery, into captivity? He says, open your eyes, look at what's already happened. And look at what the Bible says further in Leviticus 26. And he goes on and talks about the handwriting being on the wall. But it all does culminate in the return of Jesus Christ to this earth and the peace and the happiness and the joy that he'll bring to all of mankind. It is something to get excited about. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. That's all that we have time for today. We thank you for joining us, and we'll see you tomorrow.